Scientists tell us the Y chromosome is the only chromosome not necessary for life. In about 4.5 million years, they say, it will no longer exist. We are Unitarian Universalists, and we examine everything. Today we ask, what is this quintessence of dust we call a man? We seek answers and know that we will find only more questions. Nevertheless, we persist. Four members of our fellowship have agreed to talk personally about the tricky issue of being a man in these days of changing times, changing roles, and changing expectations. You know them, or maybe you just thought you did. In alphabetical order, Jay Bowman, Steve Brooks, Mike Fish, and Gary Joaquin.
Good morning. My incapacity, disability, is that one of my vocal cords does not work. I have to use 2 to 3 times the amount of air to talk than what you use. It happened after some surgery 10 years ago. I'm going to be skipping here and there. Louise and I are coming up on our 61 years of married life. But to go way back to 1945, the most traumatic thing that happened around me in childhood happened 75 years ago, just this past February 23rd. It is a story for another time. My family of origin, mother, father, and younger brother, lived through World War II in the Philippines. 2,300 of us were liberated from a Japanese civilian concentration camp on February 23rd. The same day, the American flag was raised on Iwo Jima. I was 9 years and 2 months old. To move on to Act One, I was raised in a Presbyterian family that never stayed in one place more than about 2.5 years. 6 moves in this country from 1945 to 1958. Louise and I have also moved 6 times from 1959 to the present. Moving along to Act Two, which is going back to 1959. I was young, naive. We were early into our marriage and raising 2 sons by 1963. The second son, Eric, was born the morning of John Kennedy's assassination. Several things happened through the years. I met Louise at a Presbyterian college, and she got her PhD. I don't know if anybody uses that anymore, but at seminary it meant putting hubby through seminary in Marin County. And I was into my first pastorate in the middle of North Dakota. Being a Presbyterian minister for me was frustrating and unfulfilling. What sort of man was I then? The usual, I guess. I had it made. I was white, Presbyterian, educated, superior to most working class men. Sexist, but I also had no interest in sports. Dropping back to the fall of 59, there was an anomaly. One of our wedding gifts had been the cookbook by Betty Crocker, Cooking for Two. And we each came home, me from seminary and Louise from teaching second grade. And she asked me if I could read. And I said, of course. And she handed me the book and said, asked, which meals are you going to cook? And so, way back then, I guess, I started to get liberated. I cooked for at least 2 years. Jumping way ahead, we became UUs in Corvallis in about 1978. There is much more to my story, and as there is to each man talking this morning. Strike up a conversation with us with your question at coffee after church when we can do that again. Act three has to do with being a man now, or at least through the last 4 to maybe 15 years. When a woman is telling about how some men have treated her, like Anita Hill and Christine Blasey Ford, believe her. Don't be afraid of what I used to call pushy women. Women, in my opinion, often have better answers, better plans, better solutions than men do. Have respect for everyone, no matter how hard that is, no matter the other person's size, skin color, education level, life experiences, sexual beingness. In our marriage, we've learned a lot about being co-equals, each with our strengths and abilities and our not so good things. Different than what I understand from a lot of people, we have always had one bank account. I do some cooking, vacuuming, some dusting. We share all the artwork. Louise keeps the books. She irons. I wash the clothes and dry them. You get the idea. We have also mostly practiced that neither of us has to be right. Always be open to new thoughts new constructs, new relationships, different ways of seeing anything. Life and living from 84 years of age is really about moment to moment, now to now. If you need to hold on to a belief, an old experience, or a wish for the future, it's okay to do and think that. And it's also okay to jump off a 30-foot high diving board, even if you don't know how to swim. Louise and I have been here at WOF about 3 years. It is the best place to be. To cry, search, hide, experiment with being on a committee, sing in the choir, to be accepted and loved, and your imagination or need can fill in the rest. This is a family of choice, warts and all. We can learn here and experience here what cannot be had in most other groups. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Steve Brooks, and it's been my privilege to be a member at WOF for the past 12 years or so, playing different roles. I was an RE teacher for many years, so you may not have seen me in service, but kids are grown up, moved on, and wanted to share with you what I see as three challenges for men today. And I'll start with my version of the common question, what is the root of all evil? The root of all evil is not money. It's testosterone. I came to that realization after the Sandy Hook shooting and the many school shootings we've seen after that. You can open any newscast to see the terrible violence that my male brethren inflict on this world. And you can say what you want about gun control, but toxic masculinity driven by our hormones is a major part of the problem. It often doesn't get discussed. The same goes for sexual harassment, right? To be sure, the story is more complicated than mere biology, but hormones are a powerful force, and they'll be with us for many years to come. Now, luckily, the majority of guys are able to put a cap on their glandular influences, but it's still there, I'd say, even for someone like myself. Now, I'm not your picture of Mr. Macho, and I suppose that's due partly to biology. Could be that because I was raised in the 70s with the flowering of the women's movement. Could be because I was the younger brother of two older sisters. Interestingly enough, I came to realize that my best friends from high school onward have always been in the same situation, a younger brother with older sisters. But that said, I too will fall prey and have to the forces of my male hormones. You know, I confess I've been in a group of guys and participated in sexual jokes. Not proud of that. I apologize for that. And I'd say It's just something that we need to, as men and women, help us to bring that to our own awareness, to keep that hidden force of our hormones to mind, and so that we don't feed into it. Now, awareness is a little trickier for the other challenge that I want to bring up, and that is male privilege. It's a little like chasing your shadow, though, as a guy, to be that aware of it all the time. I mean, a common example is that men typically will interrupt women and talk over them. Maybe another example is at a car shop. Oftentimes my wife has brought me in just to make sure she isn't swindled by car mechanics who will talk down to women and try to give service that isn't needed. But suddenly a guy there, you know, that's another example of male privilege. I'll share another one from a movie that had nothing to do with this, but it had this really beautiful scene. It was called White Man Can't Jump. And some of you who may have seen it might remember this scene of the lead character and his girlfriend on a hot summer day waking up in bed, and she says to him, "I'm thirsty." Without a word, he gets up, goes, comes back to bed with a glass of water. "Here you go." And she says, "What's this? I didn't want this." And he said, "You said you were thirsty." She says, "That's just the male thing to do, isn't it? I said I was thirsty because I want you to connect with me, to share with me and bond with me over that. But you males, you're always just about solving things." Right? And it's true. I mean, even when we're trying to help, that male privilege can shine through because we're trained for the man to be the hero by our culture, to solve things. And it's going to be a little more humorous example, but nonetheless, one that, as difficult as it is, we're challenged and should try to stay on top of our male privilege. The last challenge I'd like to share is the meat myth. This ridiculous notion that eating meat is what makes a man strong. Now, I want to start by just saying I uphold everyone's right to eat meat. No one should feel guilty about eating their meal choices. Totally not my message. I just want to poke a hole in the industry's perpetuation that meat is what's for dinner. A famous athlete, I'll paraphrase, says that this notion of, you know, steak is what a real man eats is just marketing. It's not based on reality. Want to guess who said that? Arnold Schwarzenegger. And you can see many examples. Trailblazer fans, you know, Damian Lillard, one of the famous point guards on the team, is vegan. There's many countless examples of reality that meat does not make an athlete or a super male. And in closing, I want to say that I'm going to pledge to be aware of the forces of toxic masculinity, be aware of my male privilege, and be aware of false advertising from the meat industry. Thank you.
Hello. Thank you for having me. My name is Mike Fish. My pronouns are he and him. My wife, Eleanor Claggett, and I joined Woof in November. I was personally attracted to Woof by the sincerity and good humor of its people. I'm honored to be invited to share a bit of myself. My context, to me, it seems gender norms and gender ideals shift through time and culture, narrowing, widening, shifting through past, future, through parents and the young, through social contexts, denoting and connoting vast constellations of behavior. Yet despite knowing about all this change, I must confess I hold some flimsy boxes of gender norms. Though I strive to have the broadest view possible of what it means to be a man and a woman, non-binary, agender, I do still have these amorphous boxes. Gray, beat-up moving boxes that have been broken down and retaped so many times, I often doubt their capability to hold much of anything, yet it's hard to put them in my blue recycling bin. So these boxes of mine are in my classroom closet next to stale glue sticks. With dust bunnies slipped under the bed Eleanor and I share. In my gym locker, with my wallet, my keys, my phone, my wedding ring, protected by a combination lock. They're leaning against my daughter's mattress. They're here. My daughter's name is Avery. She's 3. She tags along to Wolf every Sunday. We call Avery, she, her. She will probably use those pronouns as she grows up, but maybe not. She will feel empowered to follow her feelings, to express what she knows to be true about herself. Eleanor and I will always love and support our child. So now I'm here asking myself, what do I want my box labeled man to hold? And what goodness can I fit inside? What junk, what toxic trash needs to come out, to still come out? Yes, I've lifted out my fair share of trash. So, as I wrap this up, I want to tell you about one thing I definitely put in my box. It's my daughter's breath at bedtime, slowing. A poster of birds on the wall. A picture of a bunny. Mismatched socks and books strewn on a colorful carpet. A light on a timer slowly dimming. And singing every night. Whispered, murmured, croaked, loved. Hush, little baby, don't say a word. Mama's gonna show you the hummingbird. And if that hummingbird should fly, Mama's gonna show you the evening sky. That love feels very good. I definitely want that love inside my man box. I want love outside that box, too. Seems like there should be room for all the vast expressions of love in all the boxes of gender that I have, that people have. I don't know why these boxes exist and for how long they will. But being me, my version of a good man means being conscious and careful about what I put in my box, what I continue to put in my box and take out of my box, and looking to see if there's anything rotten, toxic that needs to come out. If you've got boxes too, any kind, I hope there's room for my love. And I hope I can always give it, and I hope people will always accept it. Thanks again for having me.
My name is Gary Joaquin. I've been a UU for 36 years and a member of WOOF for 69 days, 22 hours, and about 45 minutes. Why I became a UU will become clear from my story, in which I will share the events, influences, and wisdom that I have gained over the decades. The 1950s. In 1958, I was born to parents of Portuguese descent in Providence, Rhode Island. When I was 6 years old, I was hospitalized with pneumonia. This near miss with death compelled my mother, whose father died of a heart attack when she was 18, to become overly protective. The 1960s. My mother taught me compassion and to value education. My father, a skilled cabinet maker, taught me to value hard work and perfection, qualities that would become both assets and liabilities. When my father gave me my first transistor radio, I learned to love the Boston Red Sox. My hero was Carl Yastrzemski. I was also inspired by astronomy, the Apollo space program, and by the dream of Star Trek. My Catholic middle school and Jesuit high school teachers in the 1970s taught me critical thinking. I was very competitive in school, a quality that I learned to hide because I wanted to have friends. Family summer trips in New Hampshire taught me to be a planner, to navigate with maps, and to love the mountains. I learned that my parents were human beings. I hated and feared my father's temper. My mother's overly protective love became suffocating. Alan Alda was my male role model. He was smart, funny, perceptive, and a communicator. Star Wars foreshadowed my Unitarian Universalist future, positing that if there was a force, then logically it would be a natural property of all living things, not limited to mere human beings. At the University of Nebraska at Lincoln, I met the love of my life, Elisa, who taught me empathy, patience, and how to see the world through her more emotional lens. At almost the same time, I discovered my passion for architectural design, a problem-solving methodology that I would apply to almost everything in my life. I learned to trust my intuition and to test my limits. Working long hours in design studio confirmed that I was not as fragile as I had been led to believe. The 1980s. Elise and I were married in 1981. We spent a semester-long honeymoon with my College of Architecture in London, saw bits of Italy and France, and spent the summer in Rhode Island with my parents. On April Fool's Day, 1984, we discovered the First Unitarian Church of Omaha, a congregation that welcomed both my wife, the eclectic theist, and me, the agnostic skeptic. We'd found home. I started working for an architectural engineering firm in Omaha. I became an expert at computer-aided design. Eventually, we moved to Northern Virginia, where I worked for another A&E firm and even started my own business. I continued to test my limits, to quiet my negative thoughts, and to discover what was possible. The 1990s. I began working in Washington, D.C. at the International Monetary Fund on my first computer-aided facilities management system. I found my professional passion and home for the next 20 years. We joined Fairfax Unitarian Church, where our dear friend Bob Hatfield taught us about motivated self-interest, about not wasting time feeling guilty about whether or not we do good deeds because they make us feel good. Instead, we should be grateful that we are motivated to do good and keep doing it. Reverend Jim Nelson taught me to avoid tearing down someone else's good news unless I had something better to give them in return. Reverend Roberta Finkelstein taught me that we have an infinite number of apologies, even when we have done no wrong. She also taught me how challenging it is to be a minister to a diverse congregation. It's important to understand that every worship service element may not be designed for us, but it might be for a friend sitting next to us. This perspective taught me to be patient about mining for nuggets of wisdom during services. The 2000s. On March 9, 2000, my daughter Lynn was born. I vowed that she would never be afraid of her dad like I was of mine. As a parent, I learned that our children do stupid and dangerous things because they desperately need to connect, often with the worst peers. Our job as parents is to expose our children to as many positive peer groups as we can. Then if any of their friends plunge into the toilet, then the remaining peer groups will act as lifesavers, keeping our children afloat. From my manager, Surinder Rana, I learned the value of nuanced communication and of the tremendous amount of time he invested in maintaining good relationships. From my graduate school professor, Larry Williams, I learned to value the servant leader, who quietly keeps organizations running smoothly, more than the charismatic leader who is more about themselves. The 2010s. In 2013, my relationship with the IMF began to decay. I wasn't the information technology project manager that this organization needed. I decided to take an early retirement while my health was still intact. In 2014, my family and I moved to Oregon, and immediately learned what a massive job it is to rebuild the relationships that we had taken 28 years to build in Virginia. This is still a work in progress. After being consumed by work and being too much of an absentee father, I took more of an active role in my daughter's life. She attended Beaverton High School, where we discovered that one size does not fit all. Partnering with her teachers, my wife and I helped Lynn chart a more holistic program selected from academics and after-school activities that could be lived out in our community. This experience motivated me to take steps to becoming a teacher. Critical thinking is needed in our culture, and maybe I can make a difference. 2020 and beyond. This presentation would not be complete without commenting upon the non-gender conforming way in which I present. I'm not an LGBTQ activist. I'm more of a conscientious objector to the tight little box of limited self-expression in which social convention imprisons men. I question who made these rules and by what authority. In stark contrast, women have so many more options from which to choose. For many years, I conformed in order to make a living. I wore my costume to work every day. Now I choose to be myself with the fullest range of expression. Finally, it's important to note that I recently turned 60. I was looking forward to this milestone with all of the enthusiasm of a condemned man awaiting his execution. On my birthday, I ran 10 miles with my marathon training team. This experience reminded me of Chuck Yeager, the test pilot. Aviation experts predicted that the stresses of breaking the sound barrier would tear his aircraft apart. Instead, he broke through the sound barrier, and I broke through my age barrier, and we both found smooth air on the other side. Turning 60 was not a death sentence. I'm grateful that I have a lot more life to live and a lot more life to give.